My name is Darius Larson. I'm the pastor at University Lutheran Church of the Epiphany in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is a parish that has its major mandate to do campus ministry at St. Cloud State University. And the topic for today is the spirituality of civility. And last week I spent a lot more time dealing with it and breaking it down. But what I want to do now is just kind of give us an overview of what I think the spirituality of civility is. And most of it comes from a person named Pat Ellison, who just finished up her PhD work at the University of Minnesota on moral conversations. And what civility, or the spirituality of civility, I think is all about is how can we talk about things that we feel deeply about without having to come to blows with each other. I just loved it when Walt Bowman called me and asked if I wanted to be on teaching staff again. I said, well, I've been village philosopher. He said, yeah, I know that. You were out here when I was out here. But he says, I'll tell you what, this time I'll have you under the category of spirituality. I says, well, what does that mean? He says, I don't know, but it's a category you can do anything you want. I go, boy, what a definition of spirituality. It's kind of like Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, Jabberwock. You know, do you rule the word or does the word rule you? You know, I can make it mean anything I want it to mean. So, what do I mean by spirituality? Well, it's probably point one here. A lot of people talk about spirituality, at least Christian spirituality, is kind of a personal search for psychological health, you know, and I'm just kind of a follow my bliss sort of type of thing over here. The other extreme is that it's a personal search for some sort of otherworldly experience. If I can really get spiritual, you know, I don't have to deal with this world because I'm above it or I'm beyond it. What I want to view spirituality is basically it's not about seeing a different world, but seeing this world rather differently. And how do we view and see this world differently? And the word spirit, which is the root from spirituality, is that word which makes us animated, which brings life to ourselves. I think Frederick Buechner once said that it's what you don't have when you're dead. So to be a person who's concerned about spirituality is to be a person who is concerned about what gives life to people, what makes them animated, what makes them sparkle, what makes them perceive things as, I would want to say, as God perceives them. How can we be attentive to the ways that God is at work in this world? And when we are attentive to that, that can enliven us and excite us. And for years, I've used an illustration of life is kind of like a river that flows around all over the place. And you are on the riverbank looking to see where God is in this history of life. And you see God, and you jump in to embrace God at that moment. And sometimes what you think is God, you find out later, God wasn't as present as you thought. That's okay. The difference between grace and cheap grace here is that grace is where you jump in and discover God is not present where you thought God was, or at least in the way you thought God was, and you have enough energy to get back up on the riverbank and look for God again. Cheap grace is standing on the riverbank, which I think all too often we do, especially about deals with moral conversations, and go, there goes God, there goes God. And we never engage in any conversation, we never jump in to see how and what way God could be involved or would be involved in our lives, and to actually risk being embraced by God and having us embrace God. And so what I'm dealing with today in regards to spirituality is this sort of risking to have the audacity to think God is present here in this place. Civility is a much easier term than spirituality, but it doesn't mean being nice and polite. It means, as I said earlier, coming to terms without coming to blows. I just picked up somebody else's coffee cup. I'm glad it felt cold before I drank it. I go, that's not mine. Walter Ong has said that the original meaning of the word campus is this. Campus is a place where people deal with important issues without the need to bear arms. I like that definition. Therefore, a campus is supposed to be a civil place, a place of civility. And my question to us today, and my reflections in the last week when I presented this in a four-part series, is can a parish be such a campus? Can a parish be such a place where people start looking at it as a place that moral conversations happen in a way that we don't come to blows with each other, but we actually jump in and be present where we think God is? And so that's kind of the overview. And that's where I stopped and we had a long discussion, but I'm going to keep us going here, that one of the key issues that when we enter into conflicts, especially about conflicts that deeply matter, we respond in one of four different ways. We usually look, and if you just came from Pete's session, some overlaps here, we usually look for very easy answers. I mean, we got a conflict here. We're not getting along. Well, let's just solve it and get on with it and move on to the next issue. You know, council meetings are a lot like that sometimes. You know, just boom, 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 boom. And we look for the easy answer, so it will not bring us down. Or the second option is we like to play ostrich. You know, we stick our head in the sand. And we don't have a problem here. You know, some people call it denial. And we just do not want to face up to the issue that there might be conflict here, whether it be in church, school board issues, Sunday school, marriages, on and on and on. The third one, which I think the church has a corner in the market on, is that we like to murmur. I mean, there's all sorts of murmuring. It's so easy for us to find people who agree with us. And we sit over here and we just say, you know what they are about, you know, and you say, right, right, and it just feeds it all the more. And then you're doing the same thing with us, and we never talk together. And so we murmur, we put people down, we get angry, or the thing that I'm very good at is I become very cynical. You know, and I just, I don't know how we're ever going to get across anything anymore. Or we blame, like Pete was saying too, which is a big thing. And we point fingers, but we don't deal with the issue. We spend all this energy doing all this stuff out there versus between us. And the fourth one, which happens, I think, in churches all too often too, is we stop going. We just say, it's really not worth it. Or I was worth it and I risked saying something and somebody shut me up really quick and I got such hurt feelings that I'm not going to be vulnerable again. Somebody after one session I did lamented about a confirmation program and how it just was radically changed with the new pastor, and this person finally ended up just leaving that church and going somewhere else. And he says, how do you have the energy to get back up on the horse again after somebody's kicked you off? And hopefully that's what some of this stuff is all about. It's my contention that as issues become more complex, and this could be very localized issues or global issues, but as issues become more complex, conflict becomes increasingly more acute. And we don't want to get along as much as we want to be right. Okay? And as the complexity of the issue increases, let's make a nice line like this, the amount of public conversation about it decreases. So we have a lot of safe conversations over here, a lot of it, about things that aren't that complex.
But the more complex it gets, you know, the less we talk about it. Unless it's too late and it all blows up in our faces. And the main reason for this, and this I wish I thought of it, but many other people have, but I'll just explain it, is that we have our world here, and we have our public self and our private self, and we put values, opinion, religion all over here, and we put facts and knowledge all over here, and we have a dividing wall that says we cannot talk about things that deeply matter, that we hold very valued full values in any sort of public form. The big case in point is we can talk about the human sexuality statement. How do we talk about very private things in a very public way? The ELCA has done, abortion was another one, but the ELCA does a lot about trying to lay this stuff out, but not develop a process for us in talking about these things. Because almost every walks of life, we have this big dividing wall. And so I started looking, along with some other people, on how we can gently be subversive and destroy this dividing wall to allow the private and the public in some sort of common arena to talk. And our synod received a Lilly grant to try to discover a way that that congregations can be places for moral conversation. And is there a method to do this? And our congregation was one of five congregations, we've been in it 3 years now, to try to see if it's true that churches from rural America, from an educated rural university community, can actually talk about things that deeply matter to us in some sort of way that we can actually think of that there might be a third way. The other thing this does is this puts everything into a dualistic mold. We get into either or sort of thinking, that I'm right and you're wrong. And how do we come at moral conversations when usually, you might think one way is a little more right than the other way, but usually there is a third way or a fourth way or a fifth way or a sixth way. How do we even start thinking or using our imagination, as Pete was saying about it, to think of different ways of coming at whatever the problem or the issue is? And our instinct all too often is that I am right and you are wrong. And even though Pete did use it, and I didn't use it the first time, this now becomes a brain, okay? And we have the right, and how I describe what he was trying to describe in the other room, you have the right and the left side of the brain. And the problem is you have the major stem of the brain is what he referred to, what I refer to as the reptilian portion. Evolutionarily speaking, it is the most ancient part of our brain. And I describe it as the fight and flight sort of way. I don't know if Jeff, if you've had this or not, with college students who come into your office and they don't understand why they can be so somewhat mature and be able to deal with their problems at college, and they go home and they somehow revert to a 13-year-old behavior. I say, it still happens to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I have this stuff down pretty good, but somehow when I get back with my mother, something just shifts. And this reptilian part of my brain just takes over, and I just start wanting to fight, or I just say, bye, Mom, see you next month, and just walk out the door, you know? And it helps me to understand that there is this basic, instinctive, reptilian part of one's brain that just shuts down any sort of rational, emotional kind of response. And you just get enraged
That's what happens all too often in moral conversations about matters that we get our understanding with basically in some sort of subliminal way. You know, so are you with me so far here? So facts and values and all that, and let's skip all that. I just skipped lecture two. Lecture two was an interesting one because I made the mistake. I made the mistake of saying, well, any questions from yesterday? And I never really got almost to lecture two. But what I tried to say in that one is that there is such a thing as enemies. And we nice, civil Christians don't want to think that there's such a thing as enemies. Jesus doesn't ever say, don't have enemies. Jesus says, love your enemies. And we have to be clear what those are. We like to incarnate them all too often, as usually in one of you people. You know, there are different types of structures and myself and other sorts of things that we can name as enemies. But until we can really know and name who those enemies are, however strong a word that is, we had a good discussion that day of people did not want to have enemies. We do not want to have enemies. But if we don't acknowledge who our enemies are, we don't have the foggiest idea how to begin to be civil with them. Because we want to be indifferent to them. We want to not have them exist. We want to, you know, drown them. We just want to not acknowledge their presence. And so we have to acknowledge their presence. Moral conversation is much more difficult than mere ordinary discourse. And in ordinary discourse, we have all sorts of little rituals, do we not? To let each other know how much we should risk, how much we should be vulnerable with. I mean, how are you? What's your name? Where are you from? Have you been to Holden before? How's the weather? Oh, do you think the sun's going to come out? Oh, I can wear my shorts today. We have all these little small talk because it involves small risks. And while we're doing this, we probably don't, at least I don't do it consciously, maybe all of you do. You're sizing the other person up to figure out, can I risk more with this person? Can I move from small risks into bigger risks and really talk about things that matter? And then you get into, now who's going to go first? Now, how should I reveal this? Who should you reveal this? And you get into all of these rituals that we probably don't consciously think that we're doing, but if you reflect back on conversations, you find yourself doing them. And so what we try to do in these congregations through this Lilly Grant is to devise a model, and Pat Ellison will give her most credit for this model, to develop ground rules and then a process to have moral conversations. And the ground rules was basically first, Hey, do you know what that word means? That's the key to the whole thing. It's a fourfold process that was originally developed for to thinking theologically about issues by Lonergan. And it's a process on how do we attend to each other about things, how do we assert, and this is, if I could have the board, but I guess you can't do both. She called it the box to help you remember it. And you draw a little box up, and if you're going to teach this back in your parishes, you put up in the upper left-hand corner the word attending, upper right-hand corner asserting, in the lower hand left corner deciding, and then acting. And it's a way to graphically help us understand it. I would have done that on here, but my computer didn't know how to do triangles because the next one's the triangle. This is, the ground rules is the box, the process is the triangle. And what we do then is the first issue is to attend. And it's probably the most difficult, biggest step, because all too often in moral conversations, we are all right into asserting. I want to tell you what I think about this matter, right? I want you to respect gays and lesbians. I want you to honor those people. You know. Meanwhile, this other person who's never even uttered the word gay is having all sorts of anxiety about the issue. And how do we profoundly listen to the other person, to be so attentive to that person that we can at least for a moment not be worried about what I am going to say once you stop speaking? You ever in a conversation like that, you just can't wait till that person gets shuts up so I can say what I want to say? You know? And you don't even know what they're saying. That's not attending. Attending means to really to be listening to that person in such a way that you hear that person, and not only what they're saying, but what they're feeling, their body language, what their background is, where they came from to come to some of these points, to try to, it doesn't mean you have to agree with it, but you have to hear it. You have to attend, you have to be present to it. And if you want to be, which we probably shouldn't put this on the tape, but it's a wonderful method for getting your point across. Because if you are attentive to them, maybe, just maybe, they're attentive to you. Most often they're not, especially about deeply felt issues. But they will understand more why you don't buy into what they're saying, or at least you'll be able to, they will be able to hear you in such a way that they won't be quite as judgmental if you really have listened to them. And I think 90% of our problem with moral conversations is that we do not know how to be attentive to other people. How to listen openly with as little a bias as possible in order to learn as much as possible from the other person. That's basically what this is all about. And as it says up there, it takes regular and vigorous practice. Was that the part? Was that the word that was covered up? Right. That was the key word, wasn't it? R-A?
Profound.
Well, it's profound too. Profound in practice. It takes work. Try it in your own prayer life. Listen to yourself. Attend to yourself. Attend to God. It's all there. The next one, which is usually a lot easier for some of us, is asserting. By the way, I just flipped the page and I had something on top. The key question for attending is not, how can I get them to understand me? That's usually when we're in a conversation, that's what we're considering. How can I get you to understand my point? Point number one, attending, is how can I understand them? And if you could just come to a conversation thinking that the key, at least at this phase of it, is how can I understand them?
But this is kind of a male-female thing too, right? Because women have been trained to attend, and men have been trained to assert.
Yeah.
So the problem would be different if you were talking to most, or if you were a woman talking out of a background of listening your whole life and figuring out all the time, knowing exactly what people are thinking, being pretty good at it.
Yeah. The only thing I hesitate on, it's not a male-female thing. It's been a cultural thing that all too often, more the people who attend better are women, and people who assert better are men. But yeah, cultural thing. And what we need to do is we need to be both. We both need to be from Mars and Venus or whatever that book is. Pluto. Both of these, attending and asserting, are very active verbs. They take a lot of energy. And to assert does not necessarily mean that I'm asserting my own opinion here, which is, of course, the right opinion. I want to just kind of throw out an idea to kind of test what I think about this issue. And I want you to attend to it. And if you are truly attending to it, and it's not a good idea, you will find problems with it. And I want you to find problems with it if you're truly attending to my asserting. And so that it's not just me trying to prove something to you, but it's my provisional hunches all too often. And if I've really attended to you, I might even have a different provisional hunch that I started. Yes?
Well, like you're saying, like I feel asserting is like asking questions of the person talking, saying, is this what you mean? Or like the conversational skills of, you know, eye contact. You're asking, is this what you mean? Is this what I think you said? Or, you know, when you get beyond the listening part to clarify what you're saying. That's part
of your attending. If you would insert back to them and say, now is this is what you're saying? And they go, well, yeah, kind of, but a little bit more this way. That's showing that you are valuing what they're saying. At some point, though, if that's all you do in moral conversations, they will walk all over you. You won't have it if they don't care about opinion. Sometimes you have to say, now wait a minute, I've been listening to you for 40 days. I need 4 minutes here to tell you what I think about. Can you at least give me a little bit of your time here and attend to me? And if you've been modeling it, hopefully not for 40 days, but at least for, you know, a few moments, then they might listen back to you. And it's kind of a bouncing back and forth sort of thing. It's not just boom, boom. But these are the ground rules for any moral conversations to really to happen. Both of these things have to be operative, or moral conversations don't get off the ground. They escalate into all sorts of ugly, ugly ways, or you just stuff it, and those sorts of things. When this happens, they say sometimes a conversation really starts to float. I mean, when we try to, we won't have time to do this, but last week we modeled what we were talking about. We tried to talk the talk and then walk the walk, but in an artificial way, in a 50-minute time period that we had time for do it, we were pushing it too fast, and the conversation didn't float. It floats when the facilitator can kind of just sit back and people start talking to each other about this stuff. And it's not a boom, 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 back and forth, you know. And it's such a lovely thing, and you know when it's happening. And you're not even aware that you're attending and asserting, but there's just kind of fireworks going on, you know, everybody's excited about it. A good form is that way when you really get into those things around here, which we have done in the past. The problem is that all too often, if you're good at those two things, that's where you stop. Because God forbid if we have to decide something, you know? We attend and we assert for a reason, and that is to come up with some sort of decision about what it is that we are going to do about whatever this moral conversation is. At least I hope that's what we're all about. And a key way to ask is, where is God in this conversation? What is God up to? Is after you've been attending and asserting, just to kind of say, you know, to think about now, where is God in this? Mark Olson has a wonderful way. He's in a parish in Wisconsin now, but he used to be assistant to the bishop in Colorado. And he says, whenever he goes to church council meetings or some sort of conflicts in churches, he would always want their mission statement. He would always want to know what the conflict is. And as he's driving, what would Glimpse of God Lutheran Church feel about this issue? So he has this perfect church that is really attuned to the kingdom and all these sorts of stuff. And so he always kind of says, now, what is the real situation involved in this congregation? And how would a glimpse of God sort all this stuff out? And that's a way of asking, I think, the same question here of how do we decide where we should come down on whatever issue we need to come down on. And the problem is that, as Soren Kierkegaard has said about the Bible, and I think we can say this about moral conversations, is that we try to make the Bible so hard to understand that we don't have to do. The Bible is easy to understand, it's just hard to do. Loose paraphrase of Soren Kierkegaard. Moral conversations, the one last night, how many of you were here about immigration policy? You know, maybe everything that you've been talking about these couple weeks, you know, there's so much stuff. And what we do is we fall into what Robert Lifton says is psychological numbing. That we just shut down. We don't want to feel it. We don't want to deal with it. And that's where we get into, and we don't know how to decide anything. Now, the decision might be we need more information on this issue. The decision might be that we need to come back another day about this. Postponing decisions may be good. But if you do that forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, which I think we in the ELCA are trying to do with an issue called sexuality. I don't know how healthy that is. But once you decide, the fourth ground rule before we get to the triangle is to act. Just like we only have these conversations in order to make some, hopefully to come to some sort of decision. If we come to some sort of decision, maybe it's good that we actually can act upon whatever it is that we decide. And you'd be amazed how many people do not act upon their decisions, even if they can make their decision.
Isn't that usually because they're not really sure of their decision?
Yeah.
Agree, but not really believe it.
Mm-hmm. And very true, because jump the gun here a little bit, but there is a 50-50 chance that any decision that you make is wrong. And you have to know that and think about that. And what we normally do is therefore we don't make any decision, because it could be wrong. And a lot of times I jump in and I think that's where God is. And once I'm there, I know that that was the wrong decision. But that's where at least I, who is a Lutheran, can embrace the, you know, grace and say that, you know, I have the energy to get back up and try to see where God might be again and try to...
The other part is that moral discourse, I think, is sidelined by, say, commercial discourse, which is, should we buy a Toyota or a Nissan? You know, and then you make a decision on that, and you act. Mm-hmm. And if you have 40 of those on the burner at once, the moral discourse, which is like, what should we do about reaching out in our church, or what should we do about these new Hispanic families coming into town, they really get on the back burner, because they are complex. Mm-hmm. And
not only back burner, but you have a sort of a is it nihilistic? Yeah, an attitude in our society that's running rampant just about those mundane quote unquote decisions. There's so many CDs to choose from that I make this choice, and once I make the choice, I wonder if it's the right choice.
It's a kind of paralysis.
And you are just paralyzed by it.
But I think Lifton is talking about a whole different thing, which is when people are really, really under pressure because there are big things that are happening. Like if members of your family have died, or if you know, you are prejudiced or in a camp or something like that, the pressure really just shapes you deeply, versus I think we get trivialized in America by all of the kind of bogus decisions that we get seduced into making. You know, shall I smoke Camel or shall I smoke Winston?
You shouldn't smoke at all.
You know? No, but that's what's really, what's trivializing is that you shouldn't smoke at all. I mean, our culture shouldn't allow us to smoke in a certain sense, but we get these other decisions around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Christians we get undercut because the real decisions to be partnering God in this in the passion that God has for the world gets left behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Because you know we're really in a capitalistic economy and we want to have everybody employed and so we have to buy stuff and so we have to make those decisions between Toyotas and Nissan all the time.
And since the Enlightenment period to the modern period to even now the post-modernity, is this split, once again, that dividing wall, which says, if you do make any decision whatsoever, those are your own private decisions. They're not a corporate decision. And so you push these decisions not into a communal, let's discern it in the larger community, but it's my own, and you don't have the right to tell me anything either. And so we have this incredible dualistic split, and we don't know how to do either or thinking. It's difficult. Two other cautions here, besides the 50-50 chance, is the caution of confusing moral conversations with personality conflicts. If it's a personality conflict and not truly a moral dilemma, you will only, by using all this stuff, stifle or push down this personality conflict and will come out in even more unhealthy ways. The converse of that is we all too quickly blame our moral conversations on personality conflicts. And so we really have to ask the question, is this really a personality conflict and really has very little to do with this conversation? Or are we saying that it's a personality conflict so we don't really have to deal with this conversation and we can just keep it a private, a private matter? That's one word of warning. And then another one is all too often we assume that any problem is a conflict. And any conflict, therefore, if we really do something about it, can be resolved. And there's some new managerial studies going on called on polarity management, which could be a whole other kind of graph, that there are lots of things that cannot be solved. They are conflicts like, how should I spend time at work and with my family? That's not a conflict. That's a polarity that can only be learned how to be managed rather than to be resolved. So if you're in a polarity, don't try to solve it. Try to manage it. You spend way too much time trying to, all too often, to solve polarities rather than to manage polarities. And private, around here, I would think, communal gathering time and private time would be one of those polarities. How do you manage that? How do you deal with that? So, if it's not a personality problem, conflict, and if it's not a polarity, then you can use this method on moral conversations and know that about you have a 50-50 chance of being wrong. Okay? Isn't that lovely? So now we go into a process which Pat Ellison took primarily from and developed into a triangular notion of not the type of triangle that was talked about last hour, but this is a positive triangle, I hope. It's a process in which we can have some sort of sense of where we're going, because the big problem is, who's going to go first? Who's going to expose themselves first? How are we going to really get talking about these issues in such a way that conversation can actually happen, that decisions can actually be made, that action can actually be occur? And the first
part of the triangle is tradition.
First here, not first in how you deal with it. The tradition is, what does our past tell us about this? And the past can be 2,000 years ago, can be when I went to confirmation class. You know, that's usually a time of, you know, dealing with church matters where we start rebelling. What does Jesus say about it? Not Jesus from my own personal experience, but Jesus according to my to the tradition that I'm a part of. What is the traditional approach to this issue? What is the traditional view of the subject? That's a somewhat of an easy one to get at. And once I share these three, I will then describe the process. And we won't have time to do the process, but you can do it. You can do it with yourself as well as with small groups. Culture is the second part of the second part of the angle. And this is the one that usually gets, we react against. It's very easy, whatever the moral issue, to know where the culture, where we at least think the culture stands on this issue. What do we see in the newspapers? What do we hear about on the radio? What do we see on the billboards? And, you know, all this stuff that comes at us. Somebody once said, Chartres was built in what? 1200s, you may know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 1200s, that a person who walked into Chartres Cathedral and would see the stained glass windows would be just overwhelmed by all the sensory perceptions that they're perceiving at that moment, because they don't see it anywhere else. We see within, I think it's a 24-hour period, what a 12th century person saw in a lifetime as far as stuff coming at them. And so, you know, how do you differentiate between all those sorts of, you know, sorts of things? But what's that stuff coming at you is the cultural question. And I would change this one versus experience of the faithful. I think too many people got into talking about, they got too religious on this question. It's really your experience is what we're talking about here. Using your imagination, what about the issue, and let's take human sexuality, living together outside of marriage. You know, what is your experience about that? Who are the people that you know that have done this? Why have they done this? What are the reasons for this? And how do you then personally feel about that? And this is the most difficult one to deal with, and it's the one you start with on the in the process. It's the one that the more educated you are, the more difficult it is for you to get into this part of the triangle. And very quickly, the last one is, how do you then attend, if you got these three angles now in this triangle, how do you attend to the experience of the faithful? And this is, and bring the three corners together. And I'm not an artist, but Pat is, and she somehow creates out of this triangle a pyramid and adds, this is the third dimensional part of all of this piece. And what you need at this point is a root metaphor, and the root metaphor would be the cross at this point. It's out of pain, out of conflict, out of death comes new life. And unless we realize this, we're never going to end up into any sort of conflict, because we don't want to resolve anything, because all we believe is that pain brings more pain and more pain. And if you heard what Pete was saying next door here last hour, that it's only through pain can you have any sorts, you can have any sort of growth. I went through this incredibly fast. Any thoughts about this? And then I want to just walk you through
how this process is laid out. But any questions at this point?
And I don't like this hum, so I'm going to turn that thing off.
How do you convince the other person to follow these rules? I mean, it's real nice if we understand the game plan. And you try to engage it, you know, it doesn't really solve. It only solves our half of the problem, I guess.
Okay, but usually what causes the most anxiety is that nobody knows the game plan.
Sure.
Nobody knows what's going on here. There's no ritual for this, and we just think we're going to come to blows with each other. Or I'm going to speak louder than... I mean, my son and I do this all the time. I mean, if I can get louder than you and louder than me... And finally, somebody, you know... And all of a sudden, my son yells back the dumbest things. Where does he get that from? That's what I do, you know? You know, we don't have a process. And so I suppose one key question is, can we buy into this together? Can we mutually agree before we actually get started on this issue? Can we understand, are these four good ground rules? And then can we look at this process through these three points?
Another way that you can get it through without actually talking about it is just by being non-reactive and non-anxious, because the other person will feel safe.
Right.
And if they feel safe, if they really feel attended to, which is step one, you can actually kind of move the conversation without ever getting them to agree.
I think at least for the first two steps, that's probably true. When you get to the... It seems to me not everybody wants to make a decision over these kind of moral issues. And last of all, probably doesn't want to act. I mean, some of them just like to be kept on the boil on particular issues.
But if you really want it to be a communal act, it's
right.
very important to you not to decide if they don't want to decide. You don't want to decide either because
right.
you want them to be part of it. So you want to be with them over a period of time when they can actually have the courage and the fortitude to decide.
Well, I disagree. I'm the pastor, and I think it has to be done this way because we get other important things on this agenda. So
right.
let's, you know, whoa, you know, it's kind of squelches conversation.
Well, we're doing this in schools, too. We're not... a religious one, but we have to agree. We pay, you know, some a lot of money to get through this on problem solving, how we are going to run our meetings, and we all have to agree to come to agreement that that's the way we're going to run our meetings, and then we abide by that. And because of that, everyone knows they have a say, and everyone has agreed at the end of it. If over 2/3 agree to it, or whatever our percentage is, then we have to go along with it. And so, I mean, but on faith things, you don't have to get to that point, but it's the same type of idea.
You
have to get the guidelines down for everyone to see that's in there so that they all mm-hmm. play by the same rules.
We get the guidelines down, but then we also get an agenda down on what we're going to be talking about. And all too often, we put the most controversial problem issue last in hopes that we never get there. But being last is a good spot for it. I think the Roman Catholic Lutheran Dialogues was very instructive on this. They listed about 12 issues for us to learn to talk to each other about. And they said, now which one of these things might be the easiest thing to talk about? That's number one. And the things that are different. And so you start with the things that there might be more agreement about. And that's the thing you talk about first. And if you find out you might be wrong, well, let's just move that down a bit. If you're committed to stick to the process, if you really are committed. And the other issue, if it's you and I who really have the battle in this church about issue A or B, you or I should not be the person leading this process. And all too often it's the pastor who is in conflict with, back to Pete again, 4 to 6 members of the church. And the pastor is in a power struggle to talk about moral conversations dealing with these 4 to 6 people. You got to find a person who really knows how to pray. A person who really knows how to be attentive. Because one thing I haven't really talked about a whole lot in this process, but I think is crucial in this process, is how can we be people of prayer in this whole process. And the problem all too often is that we interject prayer to stifle conversation versus to help us sense the Spirit. Oh my God, we have a problem here. Let us pray. Dear God, please calm our spirit. You know, that's not what it's all about. Prayer is not meant to stifle conversation. Prayer is meant to help us open up to hear the conversation that is being had. And I think we all know in our churches and our communities people who really have a healthy sense of what that prayer is all about. And that person might be the person we need to call upon or just ask that person. Pastor Jeff of Holden Village, you are a person of prayer. Your job in this community of moral deliberation is whenever we get wherever we sense we maybe shouldn't be, call us back to who and what God is in our presence. We may forget that God is present here. And that's a good role in this place, I would think, for you. In most communities, that's the last place the pastor should be, because they will manipulate that and use that in ways that I think is not healthy. So the process now, basically, you can do it by yourself. You can, you can use it as a group. I would highly recommend you following this process about 20 different times, just by yourself, individually. Have a moral conversation with yourself before you try to do this at all with the group. Okay? And then when you try it with the group, try it with a group that it's not a crucial issue. And try it sooner so that when a crucial issue exists, comes up, you're not teaching this model, you're not trying to look for the lingo, but it becomes a process. What the Lilly Grant for us is supposed to be all about is we're supposed to now know this process so that when any sort of conflict occurs in these five congregations, we're supposed to be healthier congregations as the result of it. And therefore, they want to track us now over the years to see if when the next pastor comes to the next pastor, if there's less conflict that is unresolved. There may be still as much conflict, but how you deal with the conflict, and that's, you know, they're writing for more money to watch that
one. I think it's ever so important, and I take home with this, that you have to educate the process. You're educating it to us. But if you have a group in your church whose communication skills are set, you know, need an attunement, a fine-tuning to this process, I do think you have to have some leaders that can come in and say, well, we're going to talk about this, but this is the framework. You see, it's very important to have a framework. Because then people get more comfortable because there's structure, you know, just like kids, you like to have a little structure. Well, human adults facing like an issue of sexuality have to have even a little more structure so that we can at least have a game plan in which we're going to have this discussion. Otherwise, we do get into, out they go. You know, we get people stand up and out they go. So I think what you're teaching us is some process, which is a structure that we have to teach, really teach those of us who can, to this group before we can do it.
Right.
And people to buy into the process before they do it.
And the beauty of this process, there's many other processes, but I think the brilliance of this process is its simplicity. It's not a heavy duty thing. And what you do is, and I'll briefly go through this, and then any other questions, or if we want to eat, we got about five more minutes here. It's always good to open in prayer, and it's a prayer just to have the presence of the Spirit be with us as we deliberate whatever it is that we're deliberating. And then we need to explain briefly that we all have trouble sharing and talking about matters that are deeply felt. Third, we need to draw that box and set the ground rules. Fourth, we draw the triangle and share the triangle briefly what the three are. And then comes the crucial step, is that we have to get into our right side of our brain. And this is very crucial, and we blew it. The question we chose last time, are there any absolutes the church should uphold, was the issue last week. And I made the fatal mistake. We broke ourselves up into groups, and you should only break yourself 5 to 10 people max, so however large a group this is, about 5 to 10 to do this. Everything else is done in a larger group, but this first step. You clear your mind as much as possible, and you try to visualize a TV or a screen that's nothing on it, okay? And then you state a question, and then what image, and that was the word I did not use, what image pops into your mind when you think of moral absolute? We got into all these, we got way over into the next, three processes down here. I wanted them to say, are there any moral absolute? What I saw was a rock. And then we ask when we come back into larger group, and by the way, when you're in a smaller group, people may have strong feelings about what they've seen there. It just pops out up from them. And you don't ask the person who saw the rock to share it, but you have a recorder in the small group that just writes these things down, and you don't have to explain them too much. And if you want to share what you thought about it, that's okay. But the image is up there, a rock. Now, some people would say moral absolutes, this rock. When I see moral absolutes, I think of a rock because this rock is something that I just want to pitch at people because they're just trying to tell me where to go. Oh no, for me, a rock is that thing that I stand on, that I know where and who I am. It's my foundation. And you play with these images to try to understand them. And subliminally, right away, you're letting people know that what they're feeling and what comes from them, there are multiple ways of viewing them and dealing with them. Very, very crucial and the hardest thing. And then the next two is you deal with the tradition. Now, what does our tradition say about moral absolutes? And we've got, we had lots of quick things about that. The Ten Commandments, what does experience tell us? Experience tells us about moral absolutes is that there shouldn't be any. I mean, my son, the night before I had that session, he told me that he has learned at Holden that you don't have to follow the rules. That's what Holden has taught him. Because we were telling him all week under parental tips that kids are supposed to be where they're supposed to be for the rest of the night at midnight. Because nobody follows those rules. There's no moral absolutes here. And sure enough, we start looking, we talk to other parents, and they're all having the same frustration. We even have movies that go in this place until 2:30. A movie night, they have a double feature, but yet they're supposed to be in their home. So there's all sorts of incongruities, as there are in any of our places. So how do we have a moral conversation about that one? It is an issue. So our experience is sometimes different than what our tradition tells us they're supposed to be. And how does that make us feel? Is this image here? And then, after all that stuff is out there, and you just make three charts and just list those up as briefly as possible, three columns, you say, what does this tell us about this situation? And that's when we hope the conversation starts floating. The leader might want to make some connections. Well, this tradition thing here is kind of based on this rock issue here, kind of based on, you might help people guide them through that. But sooner than later, we hope, the conversation just starts. And you have the structure here, and they start talking about it out here versus in here. And that's what this is all about. How do we get it out there? And then Walter Wink's little book on biblical transformations, or whatever it's called, a wonderful book called The Third Way. All of a sudden we start realizing that it's not just your opinion against my opinion. But hey, now you have helped us, you have helped me see this other way of doing things. And that's basically what it's all about. It takes practice, it takes attention, and you can develop your own little method of processing through this about your own little whatever issue it is that you're personally struggling with too. I think it's a very helpful method, which hopefully will be coming out in a book very soon too.